Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bells, Spells, and Murders by Carol J. Perry. Narrated by C.S.E. Cooney. All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. Edgar Allan Poe. Chapter 1. It was the first day of December in Salem, Massachusetts, my hometown. Wanda the Weather Girl had advised the WICH TV audience to expect afternoon snow flurries and overnight plunging temperatures, and, as the old song says, it was beginning to look a lot like Christmas. I've been associated with the local TV station in one way or another for a couple of years. But this December 1st was also the beginning of a brand new broadcasting position for me. I'm Lee Barrett, nay Marilee Kowalski, 32, red-haired, Salem-born, orphaned early, married once, and widowed young. I wasn't nervous about the new job. I have a solid background in TV. Emerson College graduate, worked in Miami as a home shopping show host, did a stint on a network weather channel, taught television production at a local school, and even spent a short time as a TV call-in psychic. Not too proud of that one. My boss at the station, Bruce Doan, likes all of his employees to wear more than one hat. So in addition to doing occasional investigative reports on the late news, I'd just become WICH-TV's newest field reporter, and I was excited about it. It meant that I'd be covering events on location, reporting from the scene where news was happening. It was, I thought, a dream job come true, and just in time for Christmas. The holiday season is a big deal in Salem. It seems that everything that can hold a light bulb blazes brightly, and since the year's theme was Ring in the Holidays in Salem, a whole lot of bell jingling was going on, too. My Aunt Ibby had even tied a bell with a red ribbon onto our cat Orion's collar. He was not pleased about it. Aunt Ibby and I share the big old family home on Winter Street, where I have my own apartment on the third floor. So far, on my first morning as a field reporter, I'd stood in front of the bandstand on Salem Common, telling the audience about the traditions involved in the decoration of the annual community Christmas tree there. Next, I'd visited with a group of veterans who repaired and repainted donated used bicycles for underprivileged kids as part of a Veterans Helping Santa program. There was nothing further listed on my schedule until an 11 o'clock appointment with Albert Eldridge. Mr. Eldridge was, among other things, chairman of the Holiday Walk Committee, overseeing a popular walking tour through one of Salem's beautifully decorated historic districts. So, by 9:30, Francine, the mobile unit driver-slash-photographer, and I were headed back to the waterfront TV station on Derby Street, where a light dusting of snow had begun to fall. Having the opportunity to work with some of my old friends at WICH-TV on a daily basis made this new job even better. I checked in with Rhonda, the way-smarter-than-she-looks receptionist. "How'd you like your first morning?" she wanted to know. "I watched the Christmas tree segment. You looked good. If you were nervous, it didn't show." "Not nervous," I said. "Excited." She leaned across the curved purple formica-topped reception desk, pushing aside an improbable arrangement of glitter-sprinkled lavender poinsettias. "Okay, tell me everything," she said. "You still dating the hot cop?" The hot cop in question was Detective Pete Mondello, and the answer was a resounding yes. Still dating, still a cop, and definitely still hot. I caught her up on recent day-to-day happenings in my sometimes ordinary, sometimes very strange life, carefully omitting the stranger parts. "Aunt Ibby is going to London for the holidays," I told her. "Her friend Nigel invited her when he was here last year."
"Oh, good for her. But does that mean you'll be alone for Christmas?"
"Not alone,"
I said, Orion will be with me. And anyway, Pete's sister and brother-in-law have invited me for Christmas dinner at their house.
That'll be nice, Rhonda said. Did you know that the Doones are inviting everybody to a Christmas Eve party here at the station?
Got my invitation. I'll probably go. Sometimes Pete volunteers to work on holidays so that officers with kids can be with their families. That meant there was a pretty good chance I'd be spending Christmas Eve with my friends at WICH-TV. New Year's Eve is always reserved for Pete, though. It didn't take long for Rhonda and me to catch up on each other's lives the way good friends can, and by 10:15 Francine already had the mobile van parked in front of the building, engine running and heater cranked up when she phoned.
Ready to roll, Lee? If this snow doesn't stop, you'll have to do your interview with the old guy indoors instead of in front of the fancy-ass mansions.
I glanced at my watch. She was right. We'd be a little early for our appointment, but if Mr. Eldridge wanted to give viewers a peek at some wonderfully decorated old homes, we'd better do it right away before blowing snow made filming difficult. I said goodbye to Rhonda, pulled up the fake fur collar of my plaid wool jacket, plunked a knit hat over red hair gone wild, and hurried downstairs. The snow had picked up in intensity. Not the soft, fluffy kind, but the icy, face-stinging variety. I hurried along the sidewalk to the waiting van, pausing only to stuff a few dollars into a camo-painted kettle manned by a bell-ringing Santa with an obviously fake beard and a just as obviously genuine smile. I climbed into the passenger seat. Let's roll. It's not far from Derby Street to Washington Square, so within minutes we pulled up in front of what one might describe as a stately brick home. A discreet black and gold sign over an exquisite Samuel McIntyre carved doorway identified it as Historical Charities of Salem. The annual holiday walk was just one of the numerous fundraisers Albert Eldridge chaired throughout the year. Some of the proceeds went to maintenance and restoration of Salem's many historical sites and buildings. Other funds supported veterans' causes, aid to needy families, a community bookmobile, my librarian aunt's favorite, and, especially at holiday time, toys for kids. I felt honored to be able to meet and interview such a prominent and important citizen. While Francine remained in the van, making camera, sound, and lighting adjustments, I climbed the stairs to the handsome front door and, following instructions posted on the glass inset, entered the reception areas without knocking or ringing. A cushy oriental runner on a polished hardwood floor led to a massive mahogany desk, where a diminutive gray-haired woman welcomed me with a smile. A fragrant Scotch pine Christmas tree with Victorian-themed ornaments stood to one side of the desk, and a tall wing chair upholstered in green and gold stripes flanked the other. Several comfortable-looking club chairs were arranged attractively around the long room. Only the white plastic-topped metal table next to the door seemed out of place. An untidy row of cardboard boxes, canvas bags, and plastic tubs, all filled with a variety of items, were spread across the top. More boxes were piled beneath the folding legs. I saw canned goods, cake mixes, shampoo bottles, candy bars, detergents, packages of diapers. A pile of stamped envelopes in a wire basket marked outgoing, beside a matching one marked incoming, was at the end closest to the door. A tall barrel marked Toys stood at the opposite end.
Good morning. May I help you?
The smiling woman greeted me from behind the desk. I handed her a business card, one of my new ones, identifying me as field reporter. I'm Lee Barrett, I said. I'm early for an 11 o'clock appointment with Mr. Eldridge.
Oh, yes.
She peered at the card through granny glasses perched at the end of her nose.
Lee Barrett. Of course. I've seen you on TV. You're Isabel Russell's niece, Marilee. She speaks so highly of you.
You know my Aunt Ibby? I wasn't surprised. In her position as head research librarian at Salem's main library, I think my aunt has met just about everybody in Salem at least once.
Yes, indeed. She and I are both members of the Christmas Bells, you know.
We're going to start rehearsals this week for our holiday concert.
She offered her hand across the broad expanse of desktop.
I'm Lillian Jeffrey, Mr. Eldridge's secretary.
How do you do, Miss Jeffrey? My aunt has told me about the bells. Sounds like a lively group of musicians.
We do have a grand time together.
She glanced at a grandfather's clock in the corner.
You're quite early for your appointment. Mr. Eldridge likes to keep a timely schedule, so I'll announce you at precisely 11. Meanwhile, just make yourself comfortable.
She waved a hand toward the wing chair.
If you'll excuse me, I'll continue with my work while we chat. Mr. Eldridge likes to have all of his holiday cards hand-addressed, and as you might imagine, a man of his stature has hundreds of friends.
I started toward the chair she'd indicated.
Oh, just a moment, dear. While you're up, would you add these cards to the outgoing basket? The letter carrier should be along any minute.
I accepted a stack of envelopes, admiring perfect cursive, mentally comparing it to my own backhand scrawl, and added them to the pile.
You have beautiful handwriting, I said. No wonder Mr. Eldridge likes to have you address his cards.
I paused in front of the table.
Are all of these things for needy people?
Yes. Sorry if it looks a little bit messy. People come in and leave donations. Then some of our people pick them up and take them to the right charities. Toys for the kids, new socks and underwear for the vets, diapers go to the battered women's shelter, candy for all of them.
She smiled.
I know it looks disorganized, but it really runs quite smoothly. Things come and go from that table all day long. Look, here comes the letter carrier now.
The postman entered, said, Hi, Lily. Staying out of trouble?
Not waiting for an answer, he picked up the outgoing stack of envelopes, dropped a few pieces of mail into the incoming basket, and hurried away.
Bye, Howie,
she said to the already closed door.
The grandfather's clock chimed 11.
All right, Lee. I think you can go right on in to Mr. Eldridge's office now. I know he's expecting you. I checked just a little while ago to see if he wanted me to order some lunch for him, but he's so deep in his work he didn't even answer. A break will do him good. He's been poring over those books since I got here this morning.
Thanks. We're going to try to do the shoot outside. He'll probably enjoy the fresh air.
I walked carefully across the polished floor, hoping the heels of my boots wouldn't mar its perfection, and tapped gently on the door marked A. Eldridge before pushing it open. It was a beautiful room, as one might expect in such a house. Here was more oriental carpeting on gleaming floors, and portraits of distinguished men and elegant women lining cream-colored walls. Ashes from a dying fire smoldered in a wonderful huge fireplace, with boughs of fragrant evergreen and holly arranged on the mantelpiece. Mr. Eldridge, chin resting on his chest, red Santa hat slightly askew, appeared to be concentrating on a book that lay on his desk. I approached from the right side of his desk.
Mr. Eldridge, I said. I'm Lee Barrett from the television station. We have an appointment?
No reply. I shook his shoulder gently.
Mr. Eldridge.
The chair rolled back, and the man slid forward ever so slowly, feet first, until almost all of him was under the desk. Just his head and shoulders remained propped against the chair seat, the Santa hat at a rakish angle covering one eye. The other eye was open, bloodshot, unseeing. I backed out of the office.
Miss Jeffrey, I said, trying hard to remain calm. Please call 911.
Chapter 2. Miss Jeffrey's eyes widened, her jaw dropped, mouth open, but, good secretary that she was, she reached for the phone, dialed 911.
Tell them we need an ambulance.
I struggled to maintain a normal tone. Something is wrong with Mr. Eldridge. She repeated my words, gave the address, dropped the phone, and ran for the open office door.
The ambulance will be here soon, I said. Maybe we shouldn't touch him.
Ignoring my warning, she knelt beside his chair,
pushed the Santa hat aside and pressed anxious fingers against the side of his neck. "Cold," she murmured. "So cold." Sirens sounded outside. Francine appeared in the doorway.
"What's going on? There's an ambulance out there. Holy crap!"
She moved closer.
"Is that him? The guy we're supposed to interview? What happened?"
"I don't know." Steering Francine back toward the reception area, I looked over my shoulder to where the kneeling woman rocked slowly back and forth, shoulders trembling. "He looked as though he was just sitting there, reading," I whispered. I shook his shoulder and... I shrugged, unable to finish the sentence.
"Oh, wow!"
Francine covered her mouth with one hand.
"You shoved him out of his chair like that? Is he dead? Oh, wow!"
I'd just begun to protest the shoved him out of his chair part when two uniformed EMTs, one man and one woman, wheeled a stretcher past us and into the office. The woman gently helped Ms. Jeffrey to her feet and guided her to where Francine and I waited in the doorway. The man moved the chair aside, lowering his silent patient to the floor. The woman, whose embroidered name tag read T.J. Wells, faced us while her partner focused his attention on Albert Eldridge.
"What happened here?" she said. "Did any of you see him fall?"
Wordlessly, Francine and Miss Jeffrey each looked at me.
I guess I was there when he slipped out of the chair,"
I said, watching as the male half of the team, name tag Dom Marafa, placed latex gloves on the patient's neck, much the way Miss Jeffrey had. Shook his head, turned Mr. Eldridge onto his left side, then looked directly at me.
"He slipped out?"
I thought he was asleep. I shook his shoulder to wake him up, then he just kind of slid out of the chair. I told Miss Jeffrey, and she called 911.
"Uh-huh."
Marafa touched the back of Mr. Eldridge's head, then carefully removing both gloves and placing them into a red bag, he stood and walked toward us.
"TJ, note male patient, unresponsive, minimal rigor, call off SFD, no need, I'll phone in the 000.
Facing us, he closed the door of the office behind him.
"I'm going to call for some police assistance and we'll need to get a little information from you ladies."
I've spent enough time with my detective boyfriend to know what 000 means. It means that there's no point in performing CPR or attaching cardiac monitor leads, that the patient is beyond their help. Calling off the Salem Fire Department's emergency vehicle offered further proof. Marafa turned his back and spoke into his phone. T.J. Wells spoke softly into her own phone, then, with pen and pad poised, nodded in the secretary's direction.
"The patient's name?"
Miss Jeffrey drew herself up to her full height of about 5 feet and answered in a firm voice, "He's Albert Eldridge, Executive Director of Historical Charities of Salem. He is a very important man."
"Why are they calling the police?" Francine Stage whispered. "Should I get my camera?"
"No camera."
Marafa returned the phone to his utility belt and faced me.
"You're Lee Barrett, aren't you? I recognize you from TV. Are you here on some kind of TV business?"
I nodded. "We're here on assignment, an interview." I shrugged and glanced toward the closed office door.
"Okay, I see. Will you ladies give TJ your full names and addresses, please? The police are on their way."
Miss Jeffrey had resumed her seat behind the desk. She'd placed a box of tissues in front of her. "I'm sorry to say it, but I think Mr. Eldridge may be dead. I touched him, you know. His skin felt cold. Quite cold." My investigative reporter hat was firmly in place. There was no doubt in my mind that Albert Eldridge was dead. The EMT had told his partner to note minimum rigor. That meant that rigor mortis had begun and the man had been dead for some hours before I touched his shoulder. Besides that, I was quite sure I'd seen a red streak on one of Maratha's gloves after he touched the back of Mr. Eldridge's head. Maybe the very important man didn't die of natural causes. One at a time, we gave TJ the requested information. By the time she'd snapped her notebook shut, and Francine and I had each unzipped our warm jackets and chosen one of those comfortable club chairs, the sound of sirens once again split the wintry air. Two uniformed police officers joined us. The room, which at first glance had seemed quite large, had begun to feel crowded. Maratha, once again gloved, opened the office door, and the police, one at a time, looked inside but didn't enter. There was a low-toned conference between the officers and the EMTs. Straining to listen, I picked up enough to figure out that the medical examiner had been called. More than once, I heard the words, "Crime scene."
"As soon as the ME gives the okay," Officer One told the EMTs, "you guys will be able to take your gear and leave. You'd better bring the stretcher out here for now."
TJ remained with us while Maratha re-entered the office.
"Be careful," the second officer warned. "Try not to walk in any, fluids. Did you move anything when you were in there before? Did you put your bag down on the floor?"
"Moved the chair," Maratha answered. "Left the patient on the floor. Bag was on the stretcher."
The wheels made the tiniest squeaking sound as he pushed the gurney out of the room. The front door suddenly burst open, admitting a blast of cold air. A young man stood on the top step, a Santa hat on his head, his arms laden with gaily wrapped packages, looking just as surprised as I'm sure we all did.
"Hey, what's going on? Somebody sick? What's up with the ambulance and the TV truck?"
He peered around the room.
"You okay, Lily? I got presents here from the church lady, supposed to pick up diapers for the girls down at the shelter."
He pushed his way past TJ and piled the packages onto the table.
"Oops, cops."
He frowned.
"What's going on?"
he asked again. One of the officers moved forward.
"Who are you, and what's all this stuff?"
He pointed to the table.
"Donations for Christmas. I'm John Campbell, Santa's helper."
"Don't get smart, kid,"
the second officer spoke up. Miss Jeffrey leapt from her chair and hurried to the young man's side.
"He's not being smart, officer. John is one of our veterans helping Santa crew. There are about 100 of them around the city. They all wear special Santa hats with a little American flag sewn on. See?"
She pointed to the man's hat. Did Mr. Eldridge's hat have a flag on it? I wasn't sure.
"Okay, got it. What's all this about diapers, then?"
John Campbell answered.
"They need 'em down at the women's shelter. Some guys get mean around the holidays. The girls grab the kids and beat it. Don't blame 'em."
He picked up the stack of Pampers and Huggies.
"I'll just take these and be on my way."
Officer One held up his hand.
"Just a minute. You're not supposed to remove anything."
"Oh, for heaven's sake, officer, it's diapers."
Miss Jeffrey piled one more package of Loves onto John's outstretched arms.
"The babies need them."
Officer One pointed to the table.
"Leave them here, son. You can't remove anything from a crime scene. CSI is on the way."
John Campbell put the diapers on the table and held up both hands.
"Okay, man, there they are."
"Oh, for heaven's sake."
Miss Jeffrey pulled a small metal box from her top drawer, opened it, and removed several bills.
"Here's $50, John. Buy some diapers to tide them over. We'll straighten this out later."
"Thanks, Lily," he said.
He touched the white fur edge of his Santa hat and faced the officers.
"Okay if I leave?"
"Okay," Officer One told him. "Don't touch anything on the way out."
"I won't. Anyone going to tell me what's going on here?"
"No,"
said Officer Two as John Campbell hurried away. Through the open door, I recognized the medical examiner's unmarked black van. Miss Jeffrey's voice rose just then.
"Wait a minute. Did you say crime scene? What crime scene?"
"CSI?" Francine chimed in. "Crime scene investigation? Wow, just like on TV. Can I get my camera now?"
I was thinking of Francine's camera, too, and about how my first day as a field reporter was turning out to be pretty darned interesting. "Mind if I call my office?" I said, already punching in the number. "Rhonda, tell Mr. Doan to get ready for a breaking news spot."
Chapter 3.
With a sideways shake of her head, Francine motioned toward the closed front door. I gave an answering nod of mine, and together we moved to the exit. I'd just reached for the brass knob when a figure loomed in the glass pane and the door swung open. The medical examiner, traditional black bag in hand, stepped inside the room.
"Well, well, Miss Barrett," he said. "Why am I not surprised to see you here?"
"Hello, Doc." I wasn't surprised that he wasn't surprised. During the past couple of years, he and I have met before under similar unfortunate circumstances. Several times, actually. He didn't elaborate, and neither did I, so, as he disappeared into the dead man's office, and with Francine impatiently poking me in the ribs, I reached again for the doorknob. This time, Officer One noticed the move.
"Just a minute, ladies."
He was interrupted by another arrival. The crime scene investigation team had landed, and the first person through the door was Detective Pete Mundello. He didn't look surprised to see me either. He frowned.
"Hello, Lee. Francine. I saw the TV van outside. Thought it might be you. What's going on?"
"I had an appointment to interview the..." I motioned toward the closed office. "To interview Mr. Eldridge."
"Okay. Stick around."
When Pete's working, he's 100% all business. No one would guess that he'd just left my bed a few hours ago.
"I might have questions," he said.
I waved a hand toward the front door. "Can Francine and I..."
"Not yet. Your audience will have to wait a while."
I shrugged. Francine pouted. We returned to the club chairs. The M.E. poked his head out of the office and dismissed the EMTs, while Pete introduced himself and his three crew members to a tearful Ms. Jeffrey. My phone buzzed. "Hello, Mr. Doan." I grimaced, knowing that the station manager, having been told to brace for breaking news, wouldn't be pleased to hear that we didn't have permission to break it yet.
"What's going on over there, Ms. Barrett?"
His voice was even more gruff than usual.
"Why aren't I seeing video? I know the CSI is there. The ME, too. We stay tuned to the police band here, you know. So does every other TV and radio station. Where the hell is my story,
"I'm on it, Mr. Doan," I said. "I'm inside the building. The other stations aren't. Just need to tie up, a few loose ends with the police."
"Okay. Get on with it. Right now."
Bam. The connection ended. I knew he'd slammed his phone onto the desk. By then, Pete, his three assistants, and Officer One had gone into the office, leaving Ms. Jeffrey, Francine, and me with the remaining officer. Officer Two gave me a sympathetic look.
"Your boss?"
"Yep," I said. "He's not happy. I'm supposed to be out front telling our viewers what's going on in here."
"Guess you can't do that, huh? I mean, you can't name names. Notifying next of kin and all that."
"There's no next of kin," Ms. Jeffrey spoke up. "No one at all. He was a widower. Had no children, no siblings. His whole life was his charities."
"No kidding. Poor old guy."
The officer looked at me.
"Say, Ms. Barrett, want me to speak to the detective? See if you can do your story?"
"Would you? That'd be great."
"I'm a fan."
He colored slightly.
"I even called you once, back when you used to do the late movie show. When you used to be a psychic."
It was my turn to blush. I wasn't really a psychic, you know, just played one on TV.
"Could have fooled me. You found my lost dog for me."
"I did?"
"Well, actually, you gave me the number of the Animal Rescue League, and they already had him there."
He headed for the closed office door.
"Anyway, I owe you one. Let's see if I can convince Detective Mundello to let you and your friend go outdoors for a few minutes."
He dropped his voice.
Mondello's a good guy.
I already knew that. But did I have to tell the kind officer that Detective Mondello and...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?